Welcome to the Red Rain Podcast. Here is your host from Revenge of the Birds, Walter Mitchell.
Thank you, Kyle Little Rock Ledbetter, fresh off his Kings winning big in Toronto last night. Unfortunately, though, I think Kevin Herter went down with a shoulder injury or arm injury, so we're going to keep tabs on that. But today we're really excited to have Brett Coleman back. I mean, you know, if you haven't subscribed to his YouTube channel, you'll be pushing the 500,000 subscribers he's got going on there. It's just phenomenal. He is by now, I think you can safely say, an iconic talent evaluator, both college and pro. Brett, thanks so much for joining us. How are you doing?
Well, you're too kind, first of all. Thank you very much for all that. And I'm doing great. You know, I'm working my way through the draft class. I'm trying to get to 250 names this year, which is generally the threshold that I try to hit every year. If I can get to 250, that means generally I'm gonna be able to have thoughts and opinions on most of the guys that end up getting drafted. So that's always my goal, but it's never going to be like what an actual NFL team does, because the actual NFL teams usually hit about 1,000. So,
wow.
Yeah, all those random names that nobody's ever heard of that end up getting drafted, all the teams have heard of them.
All right, so I'm going to go right to the top of the draft. I'll say the team. We're going to get down to four to the Cardinals. Who are they going to draft? The Bears.
Caleb, 100%.
Got it. And he had his pro day yesterday and was looking pretty good there. Next up, the Commanders.
It's not what I would do, but I do expect, not that I dislike the player. I actually really like the player. I think they're going to be a top three pick no matter what, and should be a top three pick no matter what. I have a little difference of opinion in terms of which quarterback should be going next off the board, but in terms of who I expect to go off the board, Jaden Daniels.
Wow. Okay. And I'm assuming you were talking about Drake May as would have been your choice.
For me personally, yeah. I feel like his the problems that he does have, I feel, are so fixable that I'm not really worried about them, to be honest.
Well, I've been thinking about that too, and for some reason I have sort of an inkling that Cliff Kingsbury would rather have Drake May, and partly because I think that Kingsbury really likes the offensive system they have going down there, North Carolina. And like you said, the physical aspects of his game, and people underestimate what a good athlete he is too. And I think he's a little stronger and sturdier in the pocket than Daniels. But although Daniels is a real decent threat. So that'll be interesting. That is a really interesting choice that they're going to have to make there. And so, all right. So if we have Williams and Daniels going off 1-2, what about the Patriots?
That's where I expect Drake May to end up, is in New England at 3. If they don't take May at 3, then it's probably a trade down is what I would expect.
Right. And so if that happens at 4, the Cardinals' phones are going to be ringing off the hook, correct?
Oh, absolutely. Because Minnesota's coming up, whether it's 3, 4, or 5, Minnesota's coming up. Like, they're going to make a call. I would think Denver might come up. Vegas might come up.
Right.
There's going to be action there. And so they're deciding between trading down and taking either Marvin or Joe Alt is what I would expect.
Right. if you're Monty Austin for it, let's say you get a pretty decent haul from one of the teams underneath. And I also think the Giants might make a call because, you know, they recently wined and dined J.J. McCarthy. So, if they're that interested, maybe they make the jump from 6 to 4. But so if you're Monty Austin for it and you get a nice haul for trading down, would you take it?
You know, the Giants one is really interesting because that is the only pick that you could go to where you still guarantee yourself that right. You're getting either Alt or Marvin and you pick up extra assets.
Right.
Which, in my view, okay, they did the trade down last year, which Minnesota tried to come up last year as well. But, you know, Monty decided to do a deal with Houston instead because he thought Houston was going to be a worse team, that the picks were going to be better.
Right. But
we all know that CJ Stroud's amazing, right? but, you know, he just did a similar type of deal last year where he's like, hey, we need a volume of good players here, which is right. True. But at the right. same time, you look at Will Anderson did, and I have to assume or have to imagine Cardinals fans are thinking to themselves, when's our turn to just take a blue chip player, right? Like, right. when can we just do that? Do we have to trade down every time? Like, right. can we still get volume and a blue chip? And the Giants move would allow them to do that. You can pick up, like, let's say they offer us, flip them a second round pick
right.
to come up 2 spots. You're still right. going to take one of the guys that you were going to take anyway. Plus, you get a second round pick. You get another top 50 player. I think the Giants have a second round pick.
Yeah, they do. 47, I think it is.
So, you know, you flip them 47 to go up 2 spots. You still get a blue chip player. You still get an extra pick. Like, if I was Monty, that would be the deal that I pick up the phone first for. And then I would listen to Minnesota because Minnesota could also give us 2 first-round picks and give us the potential to get 2 really, really good players. But I'd listen right. to the Giants first, honestly.
Yes. Yeah, in my trade scenario with the Giants, to sweeten the pot, I have them throwing in Azeez Ojulari, who's heading into his 4th season. Last year, he was a little banged up, and he's had some injury problems. But we have his brother, BJ, so I just thought it could be a family affair. And I think the Giants have depth on the edge, so I imagine they might. That would be appealing, I think, to Monty, because we need edge help. But but if they do stay at 4 and take the blue chipper, what's your call there?
So it's tough because you kind of have to draft for who your quarterback is, right?
Right.
And so, honestly, I would get Kyler involved in the decision and be like, Kyler, what do you prefer? Would you like to have another true X receiver like when you had D-Hop that when all else fails, we can rely on that one-on-one backside? Because like that was the value of having a true badass X receiver back in those days, was that even if nobody else was working, D-Hop was always going to have that backside one-on-one. And they would go back to that well over and over and over again to kind of get themselves out of jams. And when D-Hop wasn't on the field, like, you noticed, because they didn't have that element to their offense. So I'd ask Kyler, what do you prefer, having that again in our back pocket, somebody who can win those one-on-ones, or do you want to have a potentially really good tackle tandem that will consistently give you more than 2.5 seconds to see the full field and work the full field? And I think a lot of that just comes down to what Kyler wants. And I, you know, he's the franchise quarterback. You're paying him a lot of money. I think he should be allowed to be involved in that decision, because at the end of the day, he's the one that has to operate the offense, and you kind of, you right. go what he thinks he could use most.
Right. So what's an interesting dynamic there occurred last week when the Cardinals signed Jonah Williams to a 2-year, $30 million deal, which at that point made me think that Monty was not going to go with Alt or Talese. Boy, is Talese a baller, huh? Oh, my God. What's your take on Talese Fuaga?
If you want to run the ball 30 times a game, that's your guy.
Yes.
Obviously, he can pass protect, too. But, like, people forget that. So, offensive line is the only position group that has an effect on every single play. Every single play, run or pass. Right. They have the most effect on it. And people love to take tackles that are like 290 pounds, 295, and can move really well and pass protect and everything like that, but don't really bring you a whole lot on first and second down. It's like, guys, that's half the downs. Like, we got to run the ball. And and Fuaga can do that. Like, he's a road grader who also happens to be good in pass protection. So I think he's going to go top 10 for that reason. As for the Jonah Williams side, I get it. But to me, if I have a very expensive quarterback who, you know, fairly recently suffered a major injury.
Right.
Jonah Williams is not a good enough tackle to make me not draft one. Like, okay, we're paying him fine. But at the end of the day, what really matters is Kyler upright or not?
Right.
And that's probably what I'd prioritize.
Yeah, I think speaking for myself and all Cardinal fans, one of the great questions we want to ask you is, where do you think Paris Johnson Jr. is you know, what best position do you think is for him? Left tackle or right tackle?
Well, you know, he's played on both sides. And so it kind of might be a situation where, hey, let's just get our best five on the field because we know Paris can play literally four of those spots.
Right.
He's played guard. He's played on the left. He's played on the right. He's played tackle, obviously. So it's like, hey, we have this guy that we can put anywhere. Let's assuming they take a tackle, right?
Yeah.
If they take Joe Alt and they feel like, okay, Alt can be a good right tackle, Jonah can be the left, or if they want Jonah to be the right and Alt to be the left, like whatever they happen to decide there, like they could still have Paris at guard, which I know sounds insane. It's like, oh, we invested that high of a pick and we're playing him at guard. It's like, well, yeah, because that means you have your best five offensive linemen on the field. And if Kyler Murray has a top eight offensive line in the NFL in terms of pass protection, I don't care that we spent a top 10 pick on a guard because the offense is going to be awesome. So it's like, I think people get so caught up in like positional value and stuff. It's like, is he a good player or is he not? Is the offense good or is it not? Right. Like, everybody tries to see the forest through the trees. And it's like, are we putting good players on the field? Yes or no? And I think that would allow them to do that.
See, that was you just raised a really sneaky, brilliant question because, I mean, there are some of us who privately were hoping that they'd put Paris Johnson Jr. at guard because the way he dominated 2 years ago at Ohio State. And we've been struggling at the left guard spot for a long time, Brett. It was the weak link of our line last year. And, the thought of PJJ playing left guard is really exciting, particularly because I thought we got really good play from Bejalte Froholt at center. He's a physical guy who gets after it. I mean, we wound up top five in the NFL in rushing last year, and we ran the ball really well. I mean, James Conner was just a stud, but our offensive line was attacking the line of scrimmage in ways I haven't seen before, not since the 70s with Conrad Dombler and Dan Dierdorf. They were really getting after it. But we had that one weak link, and, they have a host of guys that they're, you know, going to try to have compete at that position this year. But no one yet. I mean, they signed Evan Brown 2 days ago. He's going to be in the mix there. They re-signed Elijah Wilkinson, who was not good for the first half of the season. He got hurt, came back, and was very good down the stretch. And Tristan Colon, who filled in when Wilkinson was out, and he had some good moments there. So, but that's, I mean, if you slide PJJ into left guard, I mean, there's no question who would dominate it more than anyone else they have on the current roster. And it could save you another draft pick down the road, because I think the Cardinals are going to want to draft a guard in this year's draft to compete at that spot. So, but yeah, I mean, make a great and tantalizing argument for that. And, you know, the interesting question I'd ask you, and I trust your judgment on this, in some ways, for the Cardinals in their running game, I like Fuaga more than Ault. Would you concur with that, or you think Ault would be a better choice altogether?
You know, I can see the arguments for both. I think the physical ceiling is higher for Ault. But I think if you need somebody like, hey, a day one right tackle.
Yeah.
Where it's like, we're playing against the Raiders. We got to run the ball at Max Crosby right now.
Right.
Who is not going to get shoved into a locker on national television? Like, yeah. I could see the argument for Fuaga there. Like, truly, truly. And right. I think it's going to come down to just offensive line coach preference. There's three guys at the top of this class that you can argue for being OT1 for a variety of different reasons. Right. I don't really think there's a wrong answer, honestly.
Yeah. So just be preference again.
Yeah, and just whatever the offensive line coach prefers, you know, what they want to work with.
Yeah.
You know, what skill set Petzing prioritizes, you know.
Right. Yeah. The Petzing's offense now, which is basically a 12 and 13 personnel base, is really fascinating to me. And I think it's changed the landscape. It's hard to adjust to as Cardinal fans because, you know, we air Coryell. We have a history of Kurt Warner of just, you know, chucking the football left and right. And last year we ran the ball more than ever. It was paying off dividends in a number of ways. You know, out of 12 personnel, and then we had the emergence of Trey McBride at tight end, which was awesome. I mean, Kyler's chemistry with McBride was about as good a chemistry as he's had with anyone. I mean, Hopkins was a feast or famine situation. I mean, they threw a ton of targets at Hopkins.
You know, yeah, they had to.
Yeah. And to his credit, that first year he caught his, you know, enough to, you know, gain 1,400 yards. And the succeeding years didn't go as well as that. But the thing is now, you know, this offense with Petzing is predicated on run, play action. And what he prefer to do is, you know, play over, get guys open over the linebackers who are key and run. So, you know, my thinking was, and then I looked at the Super Bowl and the playoffs. In the final four, Brett, as you know, I mean, who are the two main receivers on every team? One is the tight end, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, you got the Chiefs have Travis Kelce, the 49ers, George Kittle, the Ravens, Mark Andrews, the Lions, Sam LaPorta. And then their go-to wide receivers aren't perimeter guys. Rashee Rice emerged for Kansas City. He played a lot out of the slot. I mean, he had 938 yards last year as a rookie. Brandon Ayuk, who they've stacked in twins and trips, often ran him over the middle, and he had a career year. Zay Flowers in Baltimore, the first-round pick. He was a difference maker for them in all areas of the field. And, of course, Amon-Ra St. Brown for the Lions. I mean, so we had – those are the final four teams last year. And, I mean, none of those receivers would fit the mold of your old classic
work the middle of the field with tight ends and slot receivers.
Right.
And work in terms of depth, the intermediate area is key. Like that, it, again, that's where the bread is buttered in the NFL. But right. You do, the value of having perimeter guys that can win one-on-one is, if you look at an example of the 49ers game against Cleveland,
right,
where in no uncertain terms, Cleveland basically played the same thing over and over and over again. We are calling one Rat, we are calling one Robert, we are calling all variations of cover one that we have, where we are playing man coverage with zone help over the middle of the field. And the only area you can attack is the one-on-ones in the perimeter. They were not going to let Purdy do anything else. And they couldn't do it. Like they could not move the ball in that game because they took away the middle of the field.
Right.
And not a whole lot of teams do that because it kind of requires having really good corners to be able to do it. But eventually, the Cardinals are going to run into a team that's trying to do that. In fact, probably in their own division with Seattle, right? So they still need to have a guy that can win outside because when you run into a team like that, especially if they run into a team like that in January, it's going to be the only way they can win.
Right.
And that's why Marvin will be on the table because I'm not super confident in them finding that type of receiver on day two. There's a lot of good receivers on day two, but that specific skill set outside of round one, it's going to be really hard to find.
Correct. Do you think that Marvin Harrison Jr. can win consistently in the NFL against NFL corners?
Oh, absolutely. Like, absolutely. I don't have any concerns about that. I don't have any concerns about his speed. Like, the GPS times were great. He's got ball skills. He's a great route runner. People have been talking about Malik Nabers being wide receiver one, and I like Malik Nabers a lot. He's probably going to be a top 10 pick. But Malik Nabers is not somebody who I'm playing outside. Malik Nabers is a slot receiver to me.
No, exactly.
So, but it's, the Cardinals specifically, it's like they got Greg Dortch. They don't need Malik Nabers like for that role. They need a guy who's going to be lining up outside. And like, I like Michael Wilson a lot too, but like, I'm not going into the season with just Michael Wilson being the only guy that I feel comfortable playing outside.
No, exactly. Would you make a push for T. Higgins?
If they felt comfortable with the money.
Right.
You know, and that's the key thing because he's going to want like $28 million a year. So it's like if they feel comfortable with the money, you sure. But at the same time, let's say they do want to trade all the way down. Like let's say they want to go to 11. And at that point, I'd be like, well, let's just keep going and do a double trade down. If they want to go to like the late teens or something like that, and just pick up Adonai Mitchell, because Adonai Mitchell can give them that perimeter skill set. And I think he's going to be a true wide receiver one in the NFL. And we can get a bunch of picks. I don't think they need another slot receiver. I really don't.
Yeah. Or I know they're really interested in Ricky Pearsall. They've been meeting with him and, you know, he could be a day two pick somewhere, to also, you know, join up with Dortch over the middle, you know, working the slot. No, it's really interesting that, with the dilemma that the Cardinals have with their base offense now, you know, I've been questioning whether Brock Bowers, because of the way Kyler clicked with McBride, it's like I've got dreams dancing in my head of Bowers on the other side, and just absolutely dominating the middle of the field in ways the Cardinals haven't done. Here's the thing, too, is that one of the knocks on Kyler has been he doesn't do well hitting shorter receivers over the middle because of his lack of height. So I was thinking, oh, we've got, you know, Bowers at 6'3" and change on one side and McBride on the other. And I mean, I was just so excited about how Kyler clicked with McBride that I thought if he had two guys like that, what a system fit. And Bowers gets after it blocking too. I mean, he's a baller. What are your thoughts on Bowers?
You know, if they traded down, and you know, they ended up either at 11 or 12 or whatever, middle of the first round, even, I'd be okay with Bowers there.
Yeah.
At 4, not so much, because I have a kind of a different take on Bowers than a lot of other people. The word generational has been thrown out a lot with him. And I just don't agree with that. Okay. I don't see him as a true Y tight end in the NFL. Like, honestly, Trey's a better Y than Bowers is in terms of somebody where I'm putting on the line of scrimmage and right. can dig out a 270-pound defensive end. Like, Bowers can't do that. He gets thrown around. He's 235 at his playing weight. It's just not going to happen, right? But where he does thrive as a blocker is as a move tight end.
Yes.
As an H-back, you know, right. we are inserting him as a lead blocker. He's a sift blocker on the backside of zone. That right. kind of stuff. Like, he does, as a blocker, a lot of the stuff that Kyle Juszczyk does. He's just an even more dynamic receiver. And so people right. got, like, offended when I said my comp for Brock Bowers is a better version of Kyle Juszczyk. They're like, whoa, whoa, whoa. And I'm like, no, whoa, whoa, whoa. Kyle Juszczyk went to 8 straight Pro Bowls. He would have been an 8-time All-Pro, an All-Decade team member. Like, he's one of the greatest H-backs, if not the greatest H-back in the history of the sport. That's a very complimentary comp to me. So, right. like, he's a great player. He's going to be a great player in the NFL. But I think he's being miscast as this, like, Rob Gronkowski, like, type tight end. He's like, he's not a tight end. He's an H-back. It's a different position. It's a different skill set. He's very good at it. But I don't think I'd take an H-back at 4th overall. Like, I don't know if I would do that. So if you get down to 11, sure, fine. Anywhere after 11, I think the further you get in the first round, the more it makes sense. But I personally would struggle taking a 235-pound H-back in the top 5.
Yeah, so next question for you. I mean, is the notion of wide receiver 1 changing now? Because of, you know, it just appears like what's in vogue now are versatile wide receivers who can win anywhere on the field. I mean, if you look at last year, right? I mean, the rookies that came in and dominated were slot guys. I mean, look at Puka Nacua. I mean, how do you explain that? You know, what's your thought on this?
You know, Puka, I think. He's somebody who I think can line up anywhere, like truly. Right. And he spent a lot of time inside early in the season when Kupp was hurt and everything like that. Because he has such great zone feel. And, you know, he works really, really hard with Stafford to understand how Stafford reads defenses so that Puka knows how to adjust his routes post-snap. He does a lot of the same stuff that Cooper Kupp does, especially when he was lined up inside.
Right.
He gets after it as a blocker, you know, which is, again, value for having him inside closer to the ball is getting him involved in blocking schemes, just like Cooper Kupp. But when Cooper came back, you saw Puka line up outside more.
Yep.
And he was great. Like, he was still like, it's like, hey, man, we're running a go route down the boundary. You got to beat press coverage. And he did it. So I think right. Cooper's one of those, or I think Puka's one of those receivers where he can kind of line up anywhere, like truly.
Right.
Whereas there's some receivers where I don't think they're built for the chaos of inside, and right. they kind of have to play outside.
Right.
Where it's just one-on-one and that's all they can focus on. Right. And there's some guys where I don't think they have the physical skill set to survive outside, but they have you know, the football intelligence and the tenacity and the willingness to get dirty so they can play inside.
Right.
I think if you can find somebody that does both, like Puka, that's a unicorn and that's awesome. But boy, they are really, really, really hard to find. That's why they get paid $30 million. But as far as you know, does a prototypical outside wide receiver one matter? I think it does for the exact reason that I talked about earlier, which is right. It is a get out of jail free card. You know, if you have a Jamar Chase, if you have a prime DeAndre Hopkins, a prime Devontae Adams, right. Somebody who is lined up outside one-on-one, you know, on the boundary side where it's like, if we don't have the look anywhere else, they're playing right. 4/3 to the field, right. Playing 5/3 to the field. If we just don't have the look,
right?
But we have that guy backside, we have the look, if you know what
yes.
I mean.
Yes.
And so it's just, it gets you out of a hole if you have that kind of receiver.
It's such a great point. And I'm really encouraged by that. Because, you know, I was looking at, I mean, check this list of the leading rookie wide receivers and tight ends last year, right? Number one was Puka Nacua, who can play anywhere on the field, right? Number two is Rashee Rice with 939 yards, 7 TDs, with 652 yak. I mean, Nacua had 639 yak. I mean, these new wave of receivers coming in, they're like yak guys. Jordan Addison, would you say he's inside, outside? He was third, 911 yards, 10 TDs.
I mean, he's kind of interesting because, like, I don't really see him as an X.
Right.
But I also don't really see him as a slot. I kind of see him as like a Tyler Lockett style Z, where it's right. Like he's outside, but we're moving him around, you know?
Right, right. Yeah, the fourth leading receiver was a tight end, LaPorta, 889, 10 TDs, 358 yak. Zay Flowers, 858, 5 TDs, 387 yak. Tank Dell, your kid, Tank Dell, I thought was on pace to get Offensive Rookie of the Year. He was on fire. 709 yards, 7 TDs. You know, I saw you guys line him up wide at times, and he was dominating from out there. What was your take on Tank?
You know, I really liked Tank. As a route runner, as a separator, I mean, even as a red zone threat, he had like 18 red zone touchdowns his last year at Houston.
Right.
Or 18 touchdowns, and like a bunch of them were in the red zone. My one concern with Tank, honestly, was at his weight, could he survive contact and hold up? That was the only thing I was kind of like, I don't know, man, because he's such a historical size outlier. I didn't question the skills. I didn't question the toughness. I didn't question the speed or the burst. Like, all that was obvious. And if he was like a buck 80, he probably would have been a first round pick. but he went where he did because everybody else was like, if he gets tagged over the middle by a linebacker, is he going to turn into a pink cloud of mist? Like that was the legitimate concern. And ironically, like he held up really well. And the injury that he ended up sustaining had nothing to do with his size. It was just a freak thing that happened. Right.
Right.
But I think he answered that question of like some guys that are under 170 just happen to also be made out of granite.
Yeah. Yeah. So finishing this list. So I was looking up the top, you know, eight or nine. So we've got Nacua, Rice, Addison, LaPorta, Flowers, Dell. The next one in was a bit of a surprise to me. It was Dalton Kincaid, Buffalo, 673, 5 TDs, 315 yak. And then Jackson Smith, Najigba, 628, 4 TDs, 366 yak. You know, and I look at that list and I'm just going like, I don't think anyone would describe any of these players as a traditional wide receiver one. So why are they winning in the NFL when the traditional wide receiver ones aren't, you know, at least last year? You know, I'm thinking back. I don't know how many of them. I mean, I guess the ones that pop out to me would be DK Metcalf.
Yeah.
You know, Mike Evans.
I think, right? You know, a lot of it is if you do catch a lot of balls over the middle, or you catch a lot of balls underneath,
right?
Where you just have space to work, like you're just naturally going to have a higher yards after catch per reception,
right?
Compared to if you are primarily a deep threat, like, and there's kind of a correlation between average depth of target and yards after catch per reception. The deeper the average depth of target, the lower the yak typically, because that means like, oh, we're probably catching balls like right at the sideline, 20 yards down the field, and then immediately getting shoved out. Yeah. What's interesting, though, about Marvin is I kind of see him as one of these rare guys that does both. If you look at Puka's yards after catch per reception last year, because he was a very good yak threat, it was 6.3. So on average, every time he caught the ball, he got 6.3 yards after the catch, which is awesome.
Nice. Yes. He's
basically almost getting a first down every time he catches it. If he catches it at like 4 yards, right? You know what Marvin Harrison Jr.'s yards after catch per reception was?
What's that?
Marvin Jr.'s yards after catch per reception was 6.2. It's 0.1 really? Yards away. So it's nice. Like he does it all too.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, once he on crossing routes, when he clears the middle and catches the ball, he is a runaway freight train.
Oh yeah.
Oh my goodness. I mean, those aspects of his game are breathtaking. And boy, can he find the end zone? I just, you know, just to get your take, you know, with the not working out and all of that, what's your take on all that?
You know, when NFL teams, like, because he told them last year at the Ohio State Pro Day when he was running with CJ.
Yeah.
Or he was running routes for CJ's drought. He told NFL teams last year, he's like, I'm not doing this again unless you guys tell me you need to see more, right? He's like, I'm going to go play my games. I got a lot of film. You know what I am. Right. But like, this is probably the last pro day you're going to see me do, so like, take it in. And then, of course, during this draft process, he's like, I'm not training for the combine. I know I'm going in the top 10 and or in the top 5. And he's like, I'm just going to go prepare to be a football player like Ja'Marr Chase did. Because he's like, I'm not going to take 6 weeks to prepare for the combine when like, I know I'm going top 5 anyway. So he's like, I'm just going to go do football training so that I can go to rookie minicamp in football shape. But he asked NFL teams, he's like, do you guys need to see me run routes at the pro day again that you just saw me run routes at last year? And they said no. So he's like, all right, cool. I'm just, you know, I'm going to keep doing my thing then. So it's one of those where it's like he gave NFL teams an opportunity to tell him to work out. And they're like, nah, we're good. So I don't really hold it against him personally because the opinions that matter are the NFL teams, right? He asked them what they wanted. They gave him an answer and he's just following what they want. So I feel like, you know, and of course people are going to be upset because they just want to see the guy work out. But the people that are actually drafting him didn't need it.
Yeah. Although it's interesting because yesterday Monty Austin for and Jonathan Gannon met with the media and how he answered the question was that he said, you know, I respect any player's decision to do what's best for them. He said, although it's always great to have as much information as you can get to be able to check all the boxes. And which I thought was, you know, kind of an equivocation, you know, like on the one hand, yeah, I get it. On the other hand, it sounded like he would have liked to have seen him run and do that.
And I'm sure they would have just because there is value to seeing a guy run up close, right? There's value to that. Like, of course, there's value to that. I think after watching him play for 3 years, if we still have questions about Marvin Harrison Jr., then there's deeper problems, you know? Like,
yeah.
I feel like he's one of those guys where it's like, don't we kind of know what he is?
Here's my thing, and correct me if I'm wrong. So I went back and watched the three closest games they had last year. I watched the Notre Dame game where he got blanketed routinely by the Cam Hart and the Notre Dame corners. Mm-hmm. I think it was his worst game of the season. Fortunately, they won on a last play off tackle run to score to win the game. That was, you know, maybe he just had a bad day and maybe it was, you know, and it was earlier in the season. So then I watched the Penn State game that they won 20-13 or whatever. And he just dominated Kalen King from start to finish.
It was, I felt bad for Kalen in that one.
No, you know, and so now I'm like, yeah, this is the Marvin I was expecting to see. But then I watched the Michigan game and it was feast or famine. You know, I mean, he came on at the end and I think he had 21 yards per his five, you know, receptions. But on balls over the middle, he was getting routinely out-leveraged and out-fought for the football, which surprised me. I mean, he just left the door open for guys to jump the roots. And, you know, he's coming back to the football, and he just looked so tentative. And I just wonder if he's being extra cautious or whatever. But then, you know, you look at the box score and you go, oh, my God, you know, he had one touchdown and 120-something yards on five or 118 yards on five receptions. It's just like, whoa. So, I mean, you were talking before about people saying that Brock Bowers could be generational. You know, I heard ever since Marvin Harrison came on the scene, he's been talked of as a generational wide receiver. And I've been, you know, buying that myself until I watched those three games. And I just thought, you know, I had some questions. You know, can you talk me down from that? I mean, am I over, you know, analyzing this or, you know, I imagine you saw those games too. So
I think the quality of quarterback play definitely played a factor as well. And you could tell as the season went on that not just Marvin, but all those receivers just didn't. They were so used to CJ throwing them the ball and right. they didn't trust it anymore. They're like, this is not the same. Right. But if you go back and watch 2022 with Marvin, where he knew full well that if there was a shoebox sized area for CJ to fit the ball into, he was going to do it. That to me was a closer version of Marvin to what we're going to get in the NFL when he has trust with his quarterback.
Right.
Or that he trusts his quarterback. And luckily Kyler's very accurate as well. Right. So right. I wouldn't have any worries about that. But the quarterback play at Ohio State last year was very disheartening. Like that team should have been a playoff team if they just had an average quarterback. Unfortunately, they didn't. And I think the team knew that and the team felt that, which is why they all came back this year when they got a transfer quarterback that was a lot better. They're like, okay, now we think we can make a run here and pull in Michigan. Yeah. Also, commentary on Michigan, shout out to their secondary because they got Mike Sander still there. They got Josh Wallace, who's probably going to be a first-round corner next year. Like their secondary and their defense in general is just full of monsters. So,
right.
And the Notre Dame defense too, boy, they got after it this year in press man coverage. If you watch the USC game, and they got a couple NFL receivers in that USC team too, with Taj Washington and Brendan Rice.
Right.
They couldn't get anything against Notre Dame. Like Caleb could not get anything against them. So I think the Notre Dame defense was very underrated, hyper aggressive. And that play style can be a little overwhelming for guys.
Yeah. I'm really glad I asked you that. Cause I'm not like waving red flags or anything. It was just, just
for sure.
You know, and sometimes when you're looking at generational, you expect more. But I also would give MHJ a ton of credit that his stat line with Stroud and McCord basically the same. So despite not having as gifted a quarterback, Marvin still put up about the same number of yards. He had more yards per reception with McCord, fewer receptions, you know, same touch, 14 touchdowns. So I give Marvin a lot of credit on that. But I'm really encouraged by what you said. So let's shift our gears before I turn it over to Kyle, because I know he's got a couple of questions he wants to ask you. Let's look down at pick 27 for the Cardinals, because they have that second, they have your pick from the Houston Texans, which, by the way, have you ever seen a rags to riches story like this? I mean, they are the envy of the NFL now, 1 year removed from winning that last season game that everyone was like, oh my God, forfeiting the first round pick. I mean, isn't this unbelievable, Brett?
They are the flip side of you know, like the early 2010s Browns that had like multiple really high picks and they missed on all of them. If you take swings at blue chip talents and miss, it can set your franchise back a lot. If you take multiple swings, especially back-to-back swings in the top five on blue chip talents and they both hit, you're set for life. Like, if you can get a CJ Stroud and Will Anderson back to back, like, you're good. Like, job security for everybody.
Right. Oh my God. And oh, this coach, DeMeco Ryans, I just love everything about the guy. His defense, I mean, when he gets it right, his defense starts playing like it was in San Francisco, it's going to be lights out. I mean, this guy in San Francisco, I've never seen a 49ers defense attack like piranhas, attack the football like piranhas the way they did. I mean, the ball's in the air, you got four guys flying at it every time, you know? And now that he's adding pieces, and oh my God, it's going to be so exciting.
Yeah.
By the way, you know, every game I watched of theirs last year, and I watched almost every one, I was like thinking of you and going like, Brett must be out of his mind right now. You know,
by like week three, where I was like, are we good? I was like, are we actually good?
Yeah. Nico Collins. Love that guy.
Yeah, he's awesome. Collins.
I mean, oh my God. So, and Will Anderson, oh man, he came on strong at the end. And plus, you got a freebie from us in my Jay Sanders, which I still can't understand why. And a second-year player like that.
Especially when, you know, it's not like the Cardinals don't need edge help.
I know. I was so bullshit when that happened. I was just like, you know, exactly, because we had one sack in the last six games, ended up 32nd in the league in sacks at 33. So speaking of, that might be a good segue into the number 27 pick. If you're the Cardinals and you know the defensive needs, let's focus on defense there. And then I'll ask you about it. If we're going to go offense, what would you do? But at 27, who would you identify for the Cardinals?
If their doctors clear it, Leiatu Latu makes a lot of sense.
Yes.
It's possible that he doesn't go in the first round because nobody clears it.
Right.
Possibly goes in the top 16. If one team clears it, his draft status will be entirely dependent on doctors, right? But if he's there at 27 and the doctors sign off, like, yeah, I think he's the easy pick.
Right. Yeah. I love that kid. And boy, does he just bang that edge. And he's got that good length. And well, that would be good. What's your take on Chop?
You know, I'm still finishing Chop. Obviously, incredibly explosive, bendy, Thicker frame than you would think for somebody with his profile. Like, a lot of people might see him as like a Barkevious Mingo type, but he's way thicker, way stronger. I don't think he's fully developed yet as a pass rusher, but I also think he has the work ethic to get there.
Right.
So I don't think you're drafting Chop for what he is. I think you're drafting Chop for what you think he's going to be.
Right.
And yep. So really it comes down to if the Cardinals need a guy that can do it right now, or they need a guy that can do it in 2027.
Right. Another guy I'd love your thought on is Cooper DeJean. If he's there at 27, would he be a guy you'd hop on?
For sure. I think the question for the Cardinals specifically is, would they want him outside or would they want him inside?
Right.
Because for me, and it's not that I don't think he can play outside corner. I think obviously he can.
Right.
But I value him as a nickel because he's very good against the run. And he's a good blitzer too. And nickel is a spot where you have to be involved in the run game. You will be involved as a pass rusher, because a lot of fire zones involve the nickel. So it's like if they view him as an inside guy, I don't know if they would take him in the first round because they literally just drafted one who I like a lot last year who plays a similar type of role in Keytrell Clark.
Right.
So if they see him as an outside guy, like I could see it at 27, but I like Garrett Williams as an eventual outside corner. Right. Star Thomas, I thought also profiled as a nickel, but they seem intent on trying him outside. Sean Murphy Bunting, I think, is an outside guy. So it's like right. They already have at least two, potentially three guys who I think could play nickel.
Right.
It just really depends on what they think DeJean is.
And of course, I love my Massachusetts bred Mike Sarenstil. Oh my God. Sarenstil of Everett High School up in right in my neck of the woods. Boy, is he a baller, huh?
He's awesome. He's might be the best pure nickel in this class, honestly. And yep. Him and Jerrion Jones from Florida State.
Oh yeah. Yeah, he's sticky. All right. So if we're gonna go defensive tackle at 27, which one would you identify? Because we need help inside. Which one? I mean, Braden Fisk, would that appeal to you? If Johnny Newton drops there, who do you got? If you were Monty, who would you like there?
Newton for sure. I would like there. Byron Murphy, I don't think will be there, but obviously he's in play too. As for first round, would I do Fisk in the first round? I'm not sure. Yeah. Like, I think Fisk might be like a top 50 guy. I don't know if he's going to be a top 32 guy. I think on day two, you could look at like Mekhi Wingo.
Right.
If you don't want like a penetrating three technique. That's the thing is that there might only be two defensive tackles that go in the first round, but there's going to be like nine of them that go in the second and third round. Like, right. There's a lot of defensive tackles in this class that are really good. But I don't know how many of them are actually going to go in the first round. I will give you a down the board guy though. If they don't address DT until either late day two, early day three, somewhere like late round three to round four, Christian Boyd from Northern Iowa.
Yeah. I watched some tape of him. I like him a lot.
He's a badass.
Yeah.
I love that kid. Clough. Whoever gets him is getting a steal.
Northern Iowa has a special place in Cardinals' hearts because of Kurt Warner.
Oh, yeah, that's right. That's right. Also, an elite strength and conditioning program, by the way.
Oh, great.
I'd put up their strength and conditioning program up against, like, SEC schools. Maybe it's because they're so big into wrestling, but...
oh, yeah, right.
Like there's always a bunch of freak athletes that come out of UNI, and that's because their strength and conditioning program is so good.
Do you know the guy there?
No, I've talked to so many other people like around the industry, and they're like, oh yeah, no, they pump out monsters there. It's like the Penn State of FCS.
Awesome.
Yeah.
you know, and a guy I don't think people are talking enough about, I can't believe when I watch the tape, is Chris Jenkins.
I like Chris Jenkins a lot. He's a freak. He's another one of these guys who's going to go in like the second round along with all like that whole other group, right? Mason Smith, Brandon Thorless.
Right.
Leonard Taylor.
Yep.
Probably Ruka Rororo from Clemson. Tavondre Sweat's going to go somewhere in the second round.
Right. Yeah, you like you said, there are 9 or 10 guys that are going to go off the boards pretty fast. So that's comforting to know, too, because we address the edge at 27 and whatnot. So, Kyle, what questions do you have for Brett?
Hello, Brett. A couple Cardinals questions and then just some general NFL ones. From the Cardinals perspective, regardless, you were talking about Marvin Harrison versus Joe Alt at pick 4 and operating under the assumption they stay at 4. Regardless of who they end up picking, do you still see them going defense with 27 and I believe 35 is their other pick, like back-to-back bottom of the first, top of the second? Do you think they go defense there both spots, or does what they do at 4 inform what they do later?
Oh, man, that's actually a really good question. I get the sense that Monty's just going to let the board come to him. And just whoever is the outlier, like, oh, my God, how is he still here?
Right.
Guy. Like, that's probably who they're going to. And it could be offensive line, receiver, DB, hopefully not inside linebacker. I hope we're past that phase.
quarterback and inside linebacker. That's all they do.
Edgerrin Cooper, you are an Arizona Cardinal. No. I really do think they're just going to let the board come to them. And I don't think they're going to rush it. I don't.
Okay. The second Cardinal question I had is just what you made of the Desmond Ridder for Rondale Moore swap, because I know Rondale Moore and Greg Dortch's skill sets are a little bit repetitive, but given the Cardinals like general lack of receivers, I was surprised that they were willing to part with a receiver so early in free agency.
It just made me disappointed about how Rondale turned out.
Yeah.
You know, like, we know Desmond Ridder's not good.
Yeah.
So it's like, that's what you think of Rondale Moore at this point, that you're getting.
Be careful saying Ridder. That in front of Walter. Walter still believes in Desmond Ridder.
But I'm just like, this kid had all the talent in the world, you know, as a true freshman at Purdue going up against a stacked Ohio State team, is the best player on the field.
Right.
What happened? What happened? Like, I don't understand what happened to Rondale Moore. And I don't know if I ever will, but I'm just disappointed that I feel like we never got to see what he could be.
Well, yeah. So does he have a chance as a true slot playing for the Falcons now? Or you think it's just a 1 year trial and then he'll hit free agency?
I think what this shows me is that the Falcons had a very similar grade on Rondale coming out. And they're also like, let's just see what's there. Because how is he not good? What happened there? Maybe a change of scenery is going to benefit him.
Well, I think with the weapons they already have there, I don't see Rondale getting many touches. But I was excited to get Desmond Ridder because, you know, that game he put on tape versus Notre Dame his senior year, where they went undefeated in the regular season, made me a fan right there. And I think going 8-9 with the Falcons actually isn't too shabby, considering what was going on there. But yeah, I mean, he's got some interesting skills. I mean, and he's a good athlete, and he's still in the development phase. But as a QB2 and someone that could, you know, start a few games for you, and maybe even, you know, play well, I thought it was a good trade to make so that they didn't have to spend one of their picks on another draft pick. I also like Clayton Toon, it'll be interesting to see how they duke it out for QB2. But Kyle, go ahead with your next question.
Yeah. So we talked about corners a little bit and the possibilities for the Cardinals. Just from a broader draft standpoint, how do you see the corners shaking out, and how many of them are, do you feel, if will end up going in the first round?
Terron Arnold for sure going in the first round. Quinyon's going in the first round. Kool-Aid, depending on medicals, might. You know, the foot, I think just team doctors got to look at the foot, see how that's coming along. DeJean might go in the first round. Again, it depends on if teams see him as an inside guy or an outside guy.
Right.
And that might be the only four, honestly. I think there's a lot of day two DBs that are going to fly off the board. Renardo Green from Florida State, Sander Still from Michigan, we talked about, Max Melton from Rutgers, Kamari Lassiter from Georgia, Rake Straw. Oh, Rake Straw has a chance to go in the first round too, actually. So maybe five. Jerrion Jones.
Yep.
Kyrie Jackson from Oregon, I think, can go on day two.
Love him. Yep.
Probably Nate Wiggins on day two, like early day two. TJ Tampa, probably.
Yep.
Maybe even Chigozie Anuzium from Colorado State. Like, there's a lot of DBs that are going on day two. In fact, it's a very deep DB class. It's just it doesn't have, like, a Sauce Gardner at the top, you know?
Right. And I'm really high on Cam Hart. Boy, he's a baller.
He's dog.
I agree. Okay, last question, Kyle. And then I have one more question for Brett.
Last question. You know what? The last question I have is just Chargers question mark to you.
Okay. That's
pretty much just want to understand what is happening there and what they might do at five. Because everyone assumes they're going to take receiver at five, and I don't think they're going to take receiver that early.
I didn't think they were going to take receiver last week. And then, you know, then they don't have any receivers anymore. Yeah. So it's like, I don't know. I guess Marvin's back on the table if quarterbacks go one through four. But I truly didn't think receiver was on the table until Keenan was gone. And I didn't expect Keenan to be gone. And I don't think they expected Keenan to be gone. I think they thought he was going to take a pay cut. And then he said no. And so they're like, oh, God, okay, well, I guess we got to trade you. But I don't think that was the plan. Mm-hmm. Was Keenan not being on the team. If the plan was Keenan not being on the team, the trade probably would have happened earlier, like before free agency, you know?
But how did they not approach Keenan with the possibility of a pay cut before then? Why do they wait so long there?
I think they did. And I think they just expected him to come around. And again, I don't have any inside knowledge on this. It's just kind of like how I read the timing of it. How I read the timing is that, you know, they approached Keenan. Keenan said no. They operated business as usual. You know, they had to let go of Mike. They're trying to figure out how to keep Joey and Khalil. And I think they just kind of expected that Keenan was going to come around, and then he just didn't. And they're like, oh, God, okay. Well, I guess we got to trade you and then figure out receivers somehow. But, like, I truly believed going into last week that the only two options were offensive tackle, corner, or trade. Now, the options are offensive tackle, corner, receiver, or trade.
Right.
Interesting.
And if the Vikings go up to four, they're probably not going to get to trade down.
Right.
Because then all four quarterbacks are going to be off the board, and they can't, like, they can't dangle Bo Nix in front of people at five.
So, right, like, you did bring up one more thing I do want to ask real quick. I don't see it with JJ McCarthy. Other people do. Just what do you think about him?
I think if so, he's got size, he's got tools, he's very coachable. He's a team first guy. Like, there's so many things to like about JJ McCarthy that make you believe in him. The only thing is, we just haven't seen him throw the ball that much.
Right.
So I think if you put him on the Jordan Love track, which I think is probably what Minnesota gets JJ, that's kind of why they signed Darnold, is they think that Darnold, they can survive a year with Darnold while JJ sits on the bench. But if he's in the Jordan Love track, or he's not going to be Mahomes, but the Mahomes track where it's like he sits first, cooks in the oven a little bit, and then play him in 2025. I like that a lot for JJ McCarthy. If you got to throw him out there week one, it's not that I don't think he's going to succeed, but I just don't know what we're going to get because we just haven't seen him make a lot of high level throws. Not because he can't, but just because that's not how the team operated. And so like you're kind of drafting on a hope and a prayer, and you're not drafting on like overwhelming evidence, like what, you know, like Caleb, where Caleb's got like a million high level throws on tape. You don't have that same luxury when you're trying to figure out JJ. So he's just a harder guy to scout.
Kyle, tell Brett, the minute that that Kyle learned that Mike Williams signed with the Jets, Kyle posted on Twitter. Tell Brett what you posted on Twitter.
Oh, you mean the joke about Mike Williams is about 2.5 plays into playing on MetLife's turf is going to end up shattering both of his knees and his Achilles at the same time.
You know, it's funny like how the Jets are putting Aaron Rodgers, Mike Williams, and Tyron Smith and Breece Hall all on the field together.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure we're going to get more than two games of them all being together.
Yeah. Someone said like Mike Williams playing on the MetLife turf is like setting it to all Madden mode and trying to stay healthy. Like just a terrible combination.
What was so funny about Kyle's tweet was that, you know, it was that graphic that goes out for the season. And then you look up and Kyle wrote, after three plays, like the Aaron Rodgers after three plays, Mike Williams' season is over.
Well, what was so funny about that behind the scenes is that I didn't have to recreate the graphic. The graphic of Mike Williams out for season already exists. I just had to stick a Jets logo over it.
Oh, that's beautiful.
That's good.
Oh, that's good. Okay, so now here's my traditional last question for Brett Coleman. What is the Coleman cocktail du jour?
Oh, man. I forgot about this question. I would say an espresso martini. I think we're in espresso martini era of our life here. Oh. But when you make an espresso martini, and I advocate for this strongly, don't use vodka. Use añejo tequila. It's way better.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, that'll kick your ass. Oh, my goodness. So how's living in the Windy City going for you?
Well, you know, it's funny. I've been in L.A. now for a little over a year, actually. A year, like a week ago. Yeah. And I've never actually lived in a downtown area of a city before. And what's fascinating about it is I now drive so little because everything's walkable.
Right.
My car literally died in the parking spot. I haven't driven since like December. And so I got in my car like a couple days ago and it just wouldn't start. And I'm like, oh, I haven't been in here since Christmas. Dead. So now I got to deal with that.
Oh, man. What a great city, huh? Oh, my God. Oh, it's just, and then Lake Michigan right there. I mean, but the photos of your crib rival the crib photos of Cliff Kingsbury.
You know, I'm just trying to emulate Cliff in everything I do, honestly.
Yeah, only you got a little air, a little altitude to that crib. what floor is it on?
I'm on the 32nd floor.
Wow. Holy cow.
Luckily, the elevators have not broken yet with me carrying groceries, but eventually I assume that will happen.
Yeah, well, hey, we wish you the greatest of draft seasons. You do such great work. I was just watching your Jared Verse video. Get on Brett's subscription list and take a look at his latest works. And he's got a one up there of the sleepers in the draft. He's always the best at that, folks. Go watch that. Give us one of those sleepers that you know, tantalize us with one of those sleepers that you put in that fit.
I will say this also. The Malachi Corley video I recorded from the desert in Arizona, like all these draft videos I recorded from Scottsdale. And I went out in the desert in Arizona the day after a thunderstorm outside of Scottsdale. And I recorded a Malachi Corley episode. And oh my God, that was the most beautiful sunset I've ever seen in my life.
Oh, great.
Like Arizona sunsets, man. Like that's, I'm jealous of you guys.
That might be a harbinger, a foreshadowing.
It's awesome. It's awesome out there. I would say Mason McCormick, guard, South Dakota State, if you really want to. He's not really a sleeper anymore, but somebody who I'm very confident is going to go in the top 100, and his future NFL fan base is going to be like, South Dakota State, who the hell is this? And then he's going to play for like 12 years and make 7 Pro Bowls. Like that's what he's going to be.
Yeah, he crushed it at the Shrine, and then PFF's just mocked him to the Cardinals in their today in their 3-round mock in the third round. Do you project him at guard or center?
That's the thing, is he could play both.
Yeah.
So the answer is yes.
Like Yogi Berra, when you come to the fork in life, take it. Yeah. So, oh wow, Brett, thanks so much for joining us. We look forward to this every year, and you're like dominoes. You deliver, and you're the best, in my opinion. I always look forward to your stuff, and it's really kind of you to come on here and engage Cardinal fans, and we're very appreciative. So, wishing you the best of luck this year.
Thank you for having me on, guys.
All right. So with that, thanks to Kyle at Rock Ledbetter, as always, for his masterful production and input. And thanks to all of you for tuning in. Last week's episode got really big numbers with Paul Bucher. I'm really appreciative of that. And in the meantime, may the red, red rain of red confetti shower down on you into the red, red sea. Red rain.